Good afternoon. This is Michelle Steinberg from the LaRouche Movement, the Lyndon LaRouche Movement, speaking to you on Independence Day, July 4th, 2009. And our guest today is Helga Zepp LaRouche, the European-based stateswoman, founder of the Schiller Institute, and wife of U.S. statesman, economist, and presidential candidate in times past, Lyndon LaRouche. Welcome, Helga, and thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, hello. It's a joy to be on this nice day with you.
Okay, great. And we're also joined from Los Angeles, California, by Nick Walsh, one of the leaders and founders of the LaRouche Youth Movement. Hi, Nick.
Hi, how's it going? I'll try to keep California from falling into the ocean out here while we're on.
Well, we definitely need that. So, listeners to the LaRouche Show, you can send in questions to by email to radio@larouchepub.com. And I say that now to get you thinking about that. So our discussion today is coming from Germany, where Helga is based, from Leesburg, Virginia, outside the environs of Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles, California. And it takes this kind of transcontinental battle to deal with the problems which face us. So let me get right in there. Helga, Mr. LaRouche this morning made a tape. It can be seen, 4-minute incredible statement, an Independence Day statement. It can be seen on www.larouchepac.com in video form, in which he talks about the unique role of the American Republic, and he identifies the role of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, the founder of modern science, the great philosopher and thinker who not only was a father of the European Renaissance, but whose contributions included sending explorers over the oceans to other continents to save the world as a whole from the oligarchic evils. You introduced our movement and me personally to Cusa, and I would like to ask you to fill out this picture further in the strategic crisis that we're faced today.
Well, you know, the evolution of the modern nation state was really the probably most important accomplishment of this period of European history, because it took centuries, literally several centuries, since the collapse of the Roman Empire for the nation state to emerge, because even after the Roman Empire was basically finished and had collapsed, the idea of an empire which was dominated by the emperor and the role of the Pope as being the one who had certain powers to install kings and so forth, that all, you know, was the structure of an empire. So if you look in the history of how it came to the modern nation state, it was a very painful and very tedious process. And Nicholas of Cusa, who was obviously a cardinal in the 15th century, in his great book Concordantia Catholica, which is essentially mostly talking about church matters, but in there, in the third book, he established for the first time the principles of what is a true sovereign nation state governed by a representative system in which the people who have been elected as representatives have a reciprocal relationship, that they have to take care of the interest of the state towards the people, but the other way around, also they have to represent the interest of the people to the state. And this idea of a representative system historically was also the first time that you could even speak about, in reality, a defense mechanism of human rights or civil rights. Because if you don't have a representative system, there is no way how the individual can participate in government, because a pure democracy does not work. That was already established by Plato and by Thucydides, the first historian of the Greek ancient Greek Peloponnesian War, that democracy is just the other side of the coin of tyranny, and that therefore, you know, what Nicolaus established with, you know, making this point about the representative system was a major breakthrough in the development of statehood. Now, obviously, this was politically not realized, you know, because Europe was dominated by by monarchies and oligarchies, and therefore, you know, it took really Columbus, who used the maps of the great Toscanelli, who was a friend of Cusa, to make these ventures into the new world. But then, you know, as you know, it took another couple of hundred years before America, you know, did indeed declare independence from the British Empire. And, you know, on this great day, the 4th of July, 1776, you know, this principle was established with the Declaration of Independence, which is one of the major documents in world history, establishing the inalienable rights of all people. Now, in that sense, you can actually say that Nicolaus of Cusa participated in the founding of America in a double way. He participated in it because of his relationship to Toscanelli and Columbus, but he also contributed very much because of his establishment of this idea of a representative system, which which was then the basis for the founding fathers, you know, to make the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence the way they did. So in a certain sense, one can say that the ideas of Nicolaus of Cusa politically for the first time got realized with the creation of the American Republic. So I think this is a very important lineage, and you know, people should really read this great man, because, you know, he had a lot to do with the coming into being of America.
Okay, Helga, let me bring our audience into what you and I are talking about. And as we discussed before the show began, we've both seen that video that Lynn made this morning. But as you know, this week has been an incredible battle in the United States, where a battle for the Republic. And what Lynn said in the conclusion of his Independence Day message, he said, again, the question is posed of the Republic versus the oligarchy. Do we in the United States still have the will to fight for these principles? And then he says, can you meet that challenge as a citizen? Or are you going to shirk your responsibility as a citizen and let the British destroy this nation once and for all? Now, that was today, this morning. 1 week ago, Mr. LaRouche gave a international webcast in which he said, we're in a situation where we're looking at the collapse of civilization. It's already in progress. This is a fight that you are the leading Republican figure in the continent of Europe day in and day out. And the broad strategic picture that Lynn, Mr. LaRouche, presented at that webcast is a very, very stark one. But here in the United States, we're seeing the Obama administration and Obama personally exerting his Emperor Nero problem in the extreme form in trying to dictatorially push through a health policy of genocide, and also a genocidal policy of global warming, which was rammed through the House of Representatives very, very quickly. Now, these policies have to do with the international financial collapse and many, many multifaceted aspects of this collapse, unemployment, global pandemic. How do you see that strategic picture today, 1 week after Mr. LaRouche's webcast?
Well, I think the developments in California, where basically the governor Schwarzenegger declared bankruptcy and is issuing IOUs, and you know, it confirms exactly what Lynn said a week ago in this webcast, that the period is characterized by the disintegration of governments, and you know, this will happen in other places as well. And I mean, if you study the financial collapse, which is now going on essentially since 2 years, because people did not implement the proposals of Mr. LaRouche, which he made immediately in August of 2007, and which could have prevented all of this, because if you had a bankruptcy reorganization in August 2007, then the entire collapse of the world economy and the real economy, leave alone the financial system, would not have occurred. But they haven't done it, and now the world is at the edge. As a matter of fact, you know, the likelihood that this thing is not going to work and that we will have a major total disintegration of the system in the next period are overwhelming. As a matter of fact, you know, we have lots of contacts, and among them some top bankers and people who agree with Lynn but still are bankers. one of them told us that their perception is that the present tenseness in the international financial markets, despite all of these trillions of bailout and liquidity pumping and you know, money creation, which quantitative easing, as they call it in Orwellian double talk, but it's actually money printing. Despite all of that, the present situation is as tense or more tense as it was shortly before the collapse of Lehman Brothers.
Mm.
Then another banker told us, who is involved with some biotechnology, and he says, look, this is the way of the future. You know, there was just a conference in which, you know, this was discussed. But they also told all their clients that despite this is the way of the future, that they should absolutely, nobody should have any stocks or other papers in their portfolio between the beginning of August and the end of October, because big things would occur in that period. So here, and this is not, you know, and this is not some somebody, but a very well-placed source. So there is no question, you know, that in Germany, for example, where we have a federal election on the 27th of September, they're putting out all kinds of stories, you know, that, you know, maybe the upswing comes 2010 or 2011, or, but all they want to do is get over this election date. And the other signs are that everybody expects a dramatic collapse immediately following this federal election, because you have, for example, low-cost clinics, you know, private clinics who are amassing, in one case, half a billion euros, because they expect the tax income of the communes to totally collapse by the end of the year, and then these communes would be more than happy to sell the public hospitals to these low-cost clinics. You know, so if you don't just look at the propaganda level on the surface, but if you actually look of how people are positioning themselves, they all expect a major, major breakdown for, you know, the later part of this year. So I think, you know, the thing which is most worrisome to me, you know, when you try to tell people that that is the condition, you know, since most people are intellectually not used to thinking in terms of processes, they're thinking in terms of issues, they think in terms of single issues, they have a certain place for that issue, another place for that issue. And they can't put it together.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what is most scary is that we are on the verge of a disintegration of the entire world system with unbelievable consequences for the life and existence of billions of people. And the people who could do something about it, you know, which is the people who are a little bit more privileged because they live in the United States or in Europe, they're not up to it. And the big question is, are people quickly enough up to it to understand that or not? I was talking to a couple of doctors a couple of days ago, and you know what they would say is, yeah, we have to now fight for our practices because we are about to go under. Yeah, we have to talk about the financial system, but no, you can't bring in California because, you know, that is too far away. And, you know, if people don't get over that, I mean, you have everywhere now, you have people who are fighting for their single issue. In Germany, the milk farmers fight. In France, the transport workers fight. The doctors fight. But if they don't take the picture at large, you know, people have to grow up. They have to, you know, they have to rise in their thinking and, you know, think the strategic situation, think the national question. And you know, since we have the 4th of July, you know, think like the founding fathers. Think in terms of these issues. Think the issues of the Federalist Papers, you know. What is required that the government can, you know, actually, or a society can actually govern itself? Is it possible? Ask the questions what Alexander Hamilton was asking in the Federalist Papers, and you know, apply these debates of the Founding Fathers and Alexander Hamilton, Benjamin Franklin. Apply these kinds of thinkings to the present situation, and then things can be solved.
Helga, let me bring in Nick Walsh from the LIM. He's in California at right on the front lines of that fight. And also this question, this very, very important question you just raised, the level of thinking, of creativity, of returning to classical principles and history. So, Nick, I know you have questions and stories to tell us.
Yeah, well, one thing, I wanted to give a quick report on how the organizing has been going out here. And then I did have a few questions, I hope. At least one that I would like to ask of Helga also. Out here, you might call it the frontier or the edge of the world at this point, because as Helga just said, within the bankruptcy and collapse of the United States under Obama's policy, you have the dissolution of the state of California. And what we're getting, though, in the field, for example, just this past week, coming off of LaRouche's webcast, is an unprecedented level of citizens that are running into our organizing tables where we set up with our literature and our signs and everything outside of grocery stores and outside of post offices and on campuses and things like this. We're getting an unprecedented level of people saying, I'm already a member of LaRouche. I signed up last week, or my husband just got a membership. This is all since, this is really noticeable since the period of April, when LaRouche came out and identified the Obama-Nero complex. And the escalation that we've taken on this healthcare genocide policy. We just had a town hall meeting out here this week in San Pedro, which is a heavy industrialized area of L.A. It's really the least Hollywood area. It's blue collar. It's mostly industries and jobs associated with the massive port harbor complex here, which handles huge amounts of imports from Asia, et cetera. And down in this area, this is where we're really getting this unprecedented density of people identifying with LaRouche personally, and with LaRouche PAC by name. People that are talking and know by name the organizers on the phone that they deal with. The other thing that I've found on top of this is we're having wild fights. I mean, some Americans who support Obama are flipping out at what we're doing. And a number of the Obama supporters, they tend to resort to not really coherent argumentation, but rather hostility, verging on
violence,
physical threats, actually physical, near physical assaults. I'm not saying everyone that supports Obama is like that, but a lot of his supporters don't really discuss ideas. They rather just curse us out. The other side of the coin, though, is that what we've seen is that the American people who agree with us, and it's somewhere around 50-50 in the field, it is kind of a split issue right now. The American people that agree with us are standing there at our organizing sites and arguing with the Americans who are yelling at us right there. Mm-hmm. And so you're getting this dynamic out in the streets right now of the recent period, the recent weeks, of a real polarized, hot fight, not only with us against the population, but us actually catalyzing in the population a certain spirit of the American Revolution, of Lincoln's Revolution, of Schiller's, you know, view of man, that we're bringing forth a little bit. And you see the American citizens themselves getting into these arguments. So there's more I could say on that. I would like to ask, if it's okay, a question on this question of CUSA. Is there a moment right now for that?
Sure. Go right ahead, Nick.
Well, Helga, the I was looking into the Council of Florence very recently, kind of backtracking from the Kepler work we'd been doing. I mean, the question I had is there's all these different figures at the Council. There's this guy, I know you'd given presentations on, George Gemistus. There's this figure, I think his name is Isidore from the Russian Church. Mark Ephesus. There's the Patriarch of Constantinople. There's the Pope, the Emperor of, I guess, Byzantium. So there's all these different figures. And given where we are and given this idea that CUSA had then, what was CUSA trying to do with this council? What was his idea, and what's its relevance for, you know, today's fight that we're in?
Well, obviously CUSA was still a relatively young man, so he did not physically participate in the council, but his significance was, apart from having contributed several of these papers, Concordantia Catholica, Docta Ignorantia, and, you know, Nicolaus was extremely conscious that he developed a new method of thinking, because he said several times that, you know, he's saying and writing things which nobody before him has ever thought, and that included Plato. And he also was very conscious that his work, his writing, would begin a new era of mankind. So, you know, it's quite amazing that he prefaced some of his writings with such statements. But apart from his general method, which is, you know, the coincidentia oppositorum method of thinking, which is extremely important philosophically, his major contribution to the Council of Florence was that he, being in the tradition of Petrarca, and, you know, Petrarca was, you know, was one of the great Italian poets. He was a humanist, and he had come across the writings of Plato, which was completely unknown in Europe for 1700 years after the collapse of the Greek classics. You know, Plato disappeared, but he found references through Augustinus that Plato must have been very important. So he was looking for writings, and there was no Plato to be found anywhere in the monasteries, which were the places where these things were. So Petrarca was one of the people who reestablished the idea that in order to know anything, you cannot go by secondary literature, but you have to go back to the sources. You have to go back to the original writers. So in that tradition, Nicolaus of CUSA, who had studied before in Padua and had, you know, met some of these people trained in this tradition of the humanist, going back to the sources idea, he had traveled to Byzantium and had found some of the early church writings, and could establish that in the early councils of the church, the filioque the Holy Spirit not only emanates from the Father, but also from the Son. Filioque, fili is the Latin word for Son, that the Holy Spirit emanates also from the Son. And that was the splitting point between the Russian and the Greek Orthodox Church, who said, no, the Holy Spirit only emanates from the Father, and the Catholic Roman Church, which said, no, the Holy Spirit also emanates from the Son. So by Nicolaus of Cusa going to Byzantium and finding these original writings, you know, inspired by Petrarca's method, he brought these documents, and, you know, then he also brought the large delegation of the Greek Orthodox Church to the Council of Florence, and that somehow scientifically established that there was no basis for the split. So Isidore, who was the representative of the Russian Orthodox Church, immediately signed the Council of Florence Unity Declaration. And, you know, for a short period of time, the church was reunified. Now, this was a major breakthrough in itself. It was unfortunately later rejected by the other leadership of the Russian church in Kiev. So it fell apart again. But, you know, for this short moment, the unity of the church was reestablished. And, you know, obviously, the other huge, major, maybe even more important aspect was that the leaders of the Russian Orthodox Church, which were all these people, Bessarion and Pleithon, they all brought the entire works of Plato. So, you know, this hit like a bomb because, you know, people had such a Plato excitement. Everybody was reading the entire works of Plato, major fathers of Florence made a Platonic Academy, and you know that really, you know, you had certain elements going into this Renaissance before. You had the tradition of Dante, you had the tradition of Petrarca, you had the great artists at the beginning of the 15th century, you had the writings of Nicolaus of Cusa, but I think what really caused an explosion and really made the change from the dark age of the 14th century to the beautiful golden renaissance of the Italian 15th century was the totality of Plato's writing. So the lessons we learned from that is, you know, how did Europe get out of the dark age of the 14th century? Well, by going back to the best tradition of the previous highest period of history, which was the Greek classic. And, you know, I mean, this is really extremely important since we are now today, I mean, we are already in a dark age. There's no question in my mind that culturally we are living in such degeneracy and depravity and people have lost so much knowledge that we are already in a dark age. But obviously the danger is that we are plunging even more deeply into a total collapse of civilization and therefore to study how did mankind come out of that, you know, with going back to these high points from universal history before, is a method which can be applied today. And that is why I think this is a very rich period of history to look at, because the golden renaissance of, you know, the count of which the Council of Florence was the high point, you know, can be a reference that mankind can somehow get out of these messes if they put their mind together and if they apply the right method.
Helga, you are very much in demand, and we've gotten a number of email questions in, and I have some questions of my own. First of all, though, I'd like to tell the listeners you can get some very important works that we have published in the past, particularly a book on Cusa's writings, Toward a New Council of Florence. This is a very important historical and poetical work, really. And you can do that by calling our 800 number for more information, 1-800-929-7566. Pretty much every day you'll find someone live to talk to you or leave a message and we'll get back to you. But the questions, Helga, that have been coming in are very much this solution to the collapse in the Dark Age that we are facing today. And as Deborah Freeman does in the webcast, I'm going to combine a couple of these questions because they deal with the same subject. And this is the response among the elites in countries like China, Russia, India, to Mr. LaRouche's ideas. Last December, you and Lynn did a series of meetings and conference presentations in India. The two of you had a number of meetings in Rome just a few weeks ago. You have traveled to Russia and China. One question that comes in from Santiago in Ibero-America, can you tell us anything on early reactions, especially from China, to Mr. LaRouche's exposition of a contrast between national sovereign credit system and the usurious oligarchical monetary system? Santiago asked this question in the context of LaRouche's drive in the early 80s for the debtors' cartel, the debtors' strike, which he called Operation Juarez. Now we need something of a similar nature, says Santiago, but not centered just on Ibero-America. Could this be pushed as a frontal attack on the oligarchy in the current breakdown crisis?
Well, I think that, you know, if you get the right spelling in Russian and in Chinese, the reason why I say you have to have the right spelling is because you have the wrong spelling, then it doesn't work. But if you have the right spelling of Mr. LaRouche's name in Chinese characters or in Russian, you find that there are thousands of web pages, of websites. And I know a couple of people who have told me repeatedly that they go daily to both the Chinese websites and to the LaRouche Pub websites, and you know they eat everything up what Mr. LaRouche is saying and writing, and I think we have in each of these countries very serious academic circles and institutional circles who are studying this question. And I think, you know, when Mr. LaRouche a week ago in the question of the recent behavior of Russia and China in that demanding going away from the dollar and replacing the dollar as a world currency with some kind of SDR or some other currency basket or regional currencies, I think the answer Lynn gave, I know that to be 100% the case, namely that, you know, these countries, Russia, China, and India, and that was confirmed to us repeatedly on a very high level in all of these countries, if there would be any sign from the United States to go in the tradition of Franklin D. Roosevelt, the New Deal, the Bretton Woods, to, you know, make an offer to end colonialism, you know, as it was Roosevelt's intention before he died, they would love to go in this direction. They would immediately join, because China is lost if the U.S. goes under. I mean, there's no way how the Chinese economy or society can outlive a total collapse of the United States. In the same way, you know, strategically, if the United States collapses, I think the effect on Russia would be absolutely devastating. And we were told, especially in India, that if the United States would join with Russia and China for such a new financial system, India would immediately go along. And you know, and when Lyndon said basically that the reason why these countries right now make such statements about, you know, SDR and so forth, it is not that they don't like Lynn's ideas, they do, but when they see that the Obama administration is, in their view, and in you know, also from Europe, one can see this very clearly, they are continuing exactly what the Bush administration was doing. You know, you can go through the list, the Guantanamo issue, the issue of Afghanistan, the issue of the Federal Reserve, of Larry Summers, of Timothy Geithner. when you see all of these things, you know, and you do not see a difference between, not a fundamental difference, maybe in little touches and little nuances, but you do not see a difference between the Bush administration and the Obama administration, except that the crisis is getting worse and worse, and that the policies which they are pushing now concerning the health policy are exactly the same ones like in Great Britain. And, you know, people are horrified. People in the whole world know what these policies are. So when they see all of that, you know, since these countries don't expect with Obama right now a positive gesture, well, what should they then do than saying, okay, then we orient it to some other arrangement? But as you could see, the recent BRIC meeting resulted in absolutely nothing, and it could not result in anything because it doesn't have the kind of combination which is necessary. Plus, you know, I really think that a lot of these things were manipulated by some very evil economists misadvising, you know, these countries. And I also know how some of these channels are working. So, you know, I think that the only way is really, you know, that we keep doing what we are doing. We keep telling people, you know, this present bailout policy is not functioning. We are on the verge of the abyss. And only if we go to a new Bretton Woods question can this be solved. And the more discussion about that in the public, the more economists, the more students, the more politicians are talking about that this is not functioning, the better. Now, next week you will have the G8 meeting in Italy. Nothing will come out of that because the way this thing is prepared right now, I don't think they will come up with a global standard to, you know, put back rules in the system. This is now supposed to be postponed to the Pittsburgh G20 conference later this year. But this is all too late, too little, and we are in a big danger. So, you know, I think that the only thing we can do is organize in every country where we are factions of people who know what is the difference between a monetary system and a credit system, who study physical economy. Lynn has written a couple of extremely beautiful and important major papers in the last period on this issue. And I think the best thing is to study these papers in depth and to circulate them widely and prepare for the moment of dramatic shifts, because they will come for sure.
Helga, you really mentioned some very, very shocking points earlier when you talked about some of the discussions with bankers who and others who are not just anybody but very, very well-placed sources, such as the tension is as great as before the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and people are being told don't have anything in paper between August 1st and October because something big is going to happen. Out in California, as Nick knows, instead of money or checks, people are getting IOUs, promissory notes, or monopoly money, which is incredible. This is a crisis in America like the time before Abraham Lincoln was elected president, which, as we know, was a time where we almost lost the republic. Now, this is of great concern because all of us as organizers find that people are asleep somehow. They seem to be sleepwalking through this crisis, and one of the most difficult things is how do we touch their souls, how do we find their souls and wake them up? Any ideas on that?
Who are you asking, me or Nick?
I'm going to ask you, and then Nick can add to that. So Helga, any ideas? How do we wake people up to this very serious crisis?
I think the only thing you can do is somehow, you know, make them self-conscious about that the world picture is larger than the issue they are concerned with. Because you know, if the FAO is now saying that the number of people going hungry every day has now increased to well over a billion people, that, you know, if the collapse occurs, it will kill, you know, billions of people. We are sitting on the verge of a pandemic, which, you know, could you know, contribute in a major way to mass death. I think we have to somehow evoke empathy or, you know, compassion. I think the biggest problem I see in terms of, you know, that people don't react is they have, the culture has dehumanized people so much, you know, between silly entertainment, violence in the videos, and the general, you know, a general cultural degeneration, you know, which has led to a people being indifferent. And indifference is the worst sin. I fully agree with the German poet from the 18th century, Lessing, who in the development of the aesthetical theory basically said the person who is the most compassionate is the best person. And I fully agree with that, because, you know, when you take responsibility for something, it makes you intelligent, because you want to learn everything about it, because your input is needed. And, you know, when you say, oh, I don't go there and I just have my little vacation for myself and my little this and my little that, then you become emotionally stupid. And I think it's important that, you know, we catch people somehow, you know, to basically show them also, you know, a vision how we could get out of this crisis. Because, you know, people must somehow, you know, I mean, Schiller, in talking about the French Revolution, you know, which the Europeans had hoped in the beginning would be a repetition of the American Revolution in Europe, and that then failed because of the Jacobean terror taking over, and, you know, then Thermidor, the reactionary terror, Napoleon crowning himself an emperor. So Schiller commented all of this by saying, a great moment has found a little people, that the objective condition for change was there, but that the subjective moral condition was lacking. And, you know, I think that that is absolutely the same problem today. And, you know, Schiller then, in writing about this whole problem in his aesthetical letters, basically said that you have to catch people. You know, people who are working every day, they are so hardworking, and they have, you know, they have not the leisure to take care of all of these questions. So therefore, you have to catch them in their leisure, and you have to uplift them when they are, you know, having free time. And, you know, the oligarchy knows that too. That's why they make the entertainment so banal and so degrading, because it pulls people down and it makes them easy slaves for the oligarchical system. And, you know, we have a much more difficult task, but if we, you know, present people with classical art and the beauty of great literature, Shelley was mentioned a lot by Lynn because he's an English poet, but there are also some very good translation of Schiller and other poets. You know, if you listen to the music of Bach, of Mozart, of Beethoven, and some of the other classical composers, you know, you can uplift people. And I was just recently watching two Verdi operas, and, you know, they're so, I mean, Schiller is so anti-oligarchical, and he gives people such a tremendous spirit about themselves. And I think, you know, in this crisis where a lot of people are going to realize that, you know, things are not going to be like they were before. You know, these are the moments, you know, where people are, as Shelley said, able to receive profound ideas about man and nature. And we have to capture that. So, you know, people should not just look at this as a, you know, academic or passive question, but they should engage in trying to change the culture. Because in moments like this, you know, things, paradigms can change. when an old paradigm is going under, and the old paradigm is right now disintegrating in front of our eyes, then you can, you know, suggest a new paradigm based on other principles. And it's this kind of a period in which we are in.
That sounds like a revolutionary situation. We have lots of questions about that, and probably Nick can communicate some of the things that the LaRouche Youth Movement out in the West Coast and nationally has for Helga. So go ahead, take it away.
Well, I think just to add to the point Helga's making about a crisis point representing a turning point, a changing point, is that really is why this outreach that we're doing here in the United States, I'm more closely connected to it, but also the outreach we're doing in Europe, the outreach we're even doing around the entire planet. Right now, I know here in the United States is having a really, creating a very dynamic response in the society. I mean, for example, there's past campaigns we've run where a lot of people coming by wherever we were set up and actually just engaging people would not pay attention to what we were saying or would walk by without responding to whatever we were calling out to them. Right now, that's not the case. Right now, there's very few people out in the areas where we're going out to engage the population that don't stop and respond, either positively or negatively, but they're responding. People are extremely, and this is what Shelley, I know, is talking about. I think people right now are gripped by a spirit of danger, you might say, a spirit of crisis, but also a spirit of requiring change that maybe a lot of these people aren't even aware they're gripped by. But when we go out there and organize and tell the truth and say what other people are not willing to say about Obama's health care policy, about the British cap-and-trade green policy of depopulation, we're going out and identifying this, and we are bringing people that are good forth, and we're bringing out the people who are nasty, we're bringing them forth too. Now, this idea of a LaRouche PAC membership drive here, I know, is very key to saving our United States, because getting the American people to say, I'm with LaRouche, we've seen that discussion at the level of the policymaking circles in the recent webcasts and the discussions, and we're also getting it on the street. I think the citizenry is mobilizable. I had one more question for Helga on this issue, on this issue underlying it, because the history of relations, Helga, between Germany and the United States and the research I've done is so crucial. Obviously, we talked about CUSA earlier, so I mean, you could say an origin point of the United States was German culture through people like CUSA and his networks. But you have the same thing. I found that Kepler was very interested in the development of the New World. Actually, he was pretty much very obsessed with keeping pace with all the developments occurring in the colonies here. And he was alive, you know, during the founding of the Massachusetts colony, although I haven't found much more about his relation to that. But then, of course, you have the role of Leibniz and all the German immigration to the United States and the German immigrants who really played a huge part in building up our country, along with the Irish and Italians and all the different European immigration. I recently drove through Texas because we were taking a car from Texas to California. And you notice in Texas, all the different cities going west towards L.A., are all German towns. Actually, more than Spanish language towns in Texas is all these German names. And I know that this relationship of the United States as an expression, not just of American kind of culture, like populists like to think, but as an actual expression of the greatest hopes of mankind, the greatest ideas of European culture. I mean, it being, you know, the 250th birthday of Robert Burns and Friedrich Schiller, I was wondering, you know, what was it, do you think, Helga, that this period of history around their lifetimes, around, of course, the American Revolution, what was it that allowed people like Schiller and Burns and Franklin to express such high levels of genius at times of great crisis?
Well, I think the period before was really, I think, what made, I mean, the Leibnizian influence both in the American tradition as well as, you know, the influence of Leibniz after his death. You know, there was this huge campaign to eliminate it by the people backing Newton and, you know, Voltaire and all of this. But somehow Leibniz inspired, for example, Kästner, the great mathematician who was the mentor of Lessing and Mendelssohn. And, you know, so in a certain sense, it was really the battle of ideas, because you had the English Enlightenment and the French Enlightenment, which basically had a conception of man, which saw man as a beast. You know, man comes as a tabula rasa and then has sense experience, and then the sense experience forms so-called ideas, which actually are not ideas, they're just experiences, but they called them ideas. And man is essentially evil. Everybody is the wolf of the other one, and you need a leviathan, you know, dictatorship to keep all these beasts in shape. That was the dominant view of the Enlightenment, both in England and also to a certain extent in the French Enlightenment. And, you know, the period before the classical period, which was the period of Benjamin Franklin's travels to Europe and so forth, there was a rebellion and against that based on the conceptions of Leibniz, which had the idea of the world being the best of all possible worlds because of the most degrees of freedom which, you know, man has through his free will. So it was the beauty of Leibniz which gave people the strength to fight off these rotten ideas of this English Enlightenment. And, you know, for example, that came then together with the revival of Shakespeare in the continental Europe, in Germany in particular. Okay. So then you had basically, you know, Leibniz, Lessing and Mendelssohn, Kästner, these people who laid the foundation. And that was then the next generation, especially Schiller, the Humboldts and so forth, which then really, you know, constituted the German classical period. And the German classical period and the American Revolution, you know, they were parallel. And, you know, in a certain sense, I think, you know, every humanist in Germany at that time, and I think also in other European countries, they looked at the American Revolution as the great battle. As a matter of fact, Friedrich Schiller, he said at a certain point, I will make some big jumps one day, and I will go to the New World, and I will work there, and so forth. And then he didn't do it, mainly because his health was always a big setback for him. But, you know, the spirit was really, you know, it was really this idea of an image of man where everybody would be potentially a genius, a potentially a beautiful soul. The idea was that the man would be able to govern himself through republics, through participation in government. So it was a period in which, you know, I mean, in a certain sense, the basis for our modern time was laid on the highest level. And I think, you know, all we have to do is really go back to these kinds of ideas and throw out all of this garbage which came then, you know, in the recent period.
Helga, we have about 5 minutes left, and I want to look to the future for a moment and ask you about the federal election in Germany that's upcoming in September. You're the chairwoman of the civil rights movement Solidarity Party in Germany. What will the major issues be in the election?
Well, I want to tell you something else first, and that is that we just had a major development in Germany, in a positive development. I mean, our listeners may not know this, but there was an effort to establish a new European Union treaty called the Lisbon Treaty, which you know, was really an effort to turn Europe into a dictatorship by having essentially all sovereignty of its member countries eliminated, and have the decision-making and legislative power all in the European Council without participation of the parliaments. Now, I led a campaign against that, very much at the dismay of a lot of people who said, you know, who were quite annoyed by this. But just on Tuesday of this week, the Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe responded to several constitutional complaints which had challenged the legality of that treaty.
Great.
Now, the court ruling is extremely important. While on the one side it said, you know, that the Lisbon Treaty is in cohesion with the German Constitution. However, then they list a couple of points, namely that, you know, the sovereignty of Germany cannot be touched, that certain principles of the German Constitution are eternal and cannot be changed by anybody, and so forth and so on. They re-established the sovereignty of Germany and said that any interpretation of this Lisbon Treaty has to take this ruling into account, and it's 150 pages ruling. So that is extremely important. Already as a result, you know, people in other countries say, well, if the German Constitutional Court says this, then, you know, we have the same right and can also establish our sovereignty. And so this is extremely important. Then the second point, which is even more incredible, is that the German parliament, which had voted not only for the Lisbon Treaty, but who also had voted in an accompanying law, which was supposed to strengthen the power of the parliament, they did the opposite and gave all the rights to the Brussels bureaucracy, and the Constitutional Court in Karlsruhe ruled that anti-constitutional. And now they are forced to rewrite that law, including all these 150 pages of legal argument, but basically, you know, strengthening the role of the parliament to defend the common good of the people. So I just wrote an article in saying that, you know, a parliament where except 59 people who voted no and one abstention is gambling away the rights of the people in such an unbelievable, irresponsible fashion. None of these people should be ever voted again in, because if they play with the, and you know, it's very clear why they did it, because they did it because the government wanted them to do it, and they haven't read the treaty, so they just voted it and gambled all the powers to Brussels. Now, I mean, obviously this will be a big issue in the election campaign, because, you know, I will make it an argument, how can you trust any politician who did that?
Right.
So, I mean, other issues will be, you know, the health policy, where, you know, it's not yet as bad as in the United States, but, you know, this whole drive to privatize everything, there is a clear tendency here too, and, you know, there is a big, big mobilization among doctors, because, you know, in Germany, people are much more sensitive. You know, when certain categories of people in the health system are all of a sudden declared to be, you know, that their life is not worth living, which is what these British health policies, on which the Obama policy is modeled, are echoing. In Germany, this has a big tradition, you know, because here, you had in the entire post-war period a big debate what eugenics was. You had a big debate among doctors that, you know, these changes occur with little changes in the beginning. First, it's only some categories of people who are declared not to be worth to be maintained, but then, you know, as the crisis becomes worse, you know, these things tend to end up the way they did in Germany in this horrible period of the Nazi period. So people are very sensitivized, and, you know, in France, for example, the doctors now have come out and said we have to go back into a resistance mode, you know, like it, as it was against in the resistance against the Nazi policy, because people see the signs of the time that as the economic crisis gets worse, and once you start to question the value of life, then, you know, you get into a slippery slope and, you know, the dam is breaking and then, you know, everything is lost. And here it's a very touchy issue because Germany has this horrible history and, you know, therefore we are fighting very hard that this is never happening again.
Well, on that note, we are a little bit over time, but I'm going to ask one more question on that because it goes right to the point. Here in the United States, the front end of our campaign against what President Obama is doing is this fight against legalizing euthanasia and rationing health care. And we saw in England, in Britain, there's a push to make euthanasia legal and to make family-assisted suicide legal. So this healthcare, Helga, I think you have a very, very unique perspective. This isn't a U.S. issue or a German issue or something. This is a universal question of human rights. And how far do you think we can go in defeating it internationally?
Well, I think that, you know, what we have to fight around is the issue of the right to life, because, you know, that is really what is at stake, because, you know, human beings are not animals. You know, if an animal is suffering, you can, you know, may think that, you know, you put it out of your misery. But human beings, you know, I mean, I think the issue is the sacredness of the human life and in a certain sense the creative power, you know, of a human being, you know, and what it means, you know, to start dismantling that image of man, you know, then we turn society over to a bestial world outlook. And there are many examples in history where you can see where this is really going. So I think, you know, when we tell people that, and, you know, also, you know, take the brainwashing away where old people are, you know, pressured that they shouldn't cost so much money, and then they write these patient living wills, I mean, that's just totally evil. And I think, you know, I think that this issue is one of the decisive, if not the decisive issues, because, you know, people who may not understand how banking works and how, you know, credit speculation and derivative and toxic waste and all of these functions, they understand that if the bailout for the banks, you know, is compensated by taking money away from the healthcare of the people, then they can understand the connection of the financial breakdown crisis and how it affects their personal life. And, you know, I think that therefore the health issue in a certain sense is the way for people to understand that, you know, we need a new financial system and that they have to take the larger issue. If we succeed or not, I have no idea. All I can tell you, if we do not succeed, then the result is so horrible that, you know, it's not even worth talking about it or painting it because as a picture, because it's the end of civilization for a very long time to come. And therefore, I think people should take the energy and just say, you know, we had in Germany the best health system in the world. You had Hill-Burton. You had, you know, other health systems in France, for example, who were excellent. And we just should go back to them. And we should have a productive economy, and then we can afford our health system. And, you know, it's simply that that solutions are no longer possible just for one issue. People have to rise and take the whole thing.
Helga, thank you for being with us. I thank you on behalf of all of our listeners on this this day of joy, crisis, and opportunity at the same time. And we hope to hear more from you in the very near future about the campaign as it develops and the results of the fight for the same kind of alliance that was represented by Cusa, Columbus, Friedrich Schiller, Benjamin Franklin, and so forth. This is Michelle Steinberg speaking on The LaRouche Show for July 4th, 2009. Thanks for joining us.